hugely popular.
And coming to busy season, I thought you were talking about Bridget and I.
Yes, yeah, so did I for a moment there too, and I was like, yeah.
I'm getting to you two. It's always busy season in your business. That was Gareth Hughes, who is a political commentator with him, Bridget Morton. They're in the Whanganui Tara Wellington studio. With me, our political commentators today, kia ora korua.
Morena.
I thought you were going to say you want the gelato delivered
the gelato
by the end of. Gareth's a former Green MP, now works for the Wellbeing Economy Alliance. Aotearoa, no longer a member of any political party. Bridget's a director with public and commercial law firm Franks Ogilvie, former senior ministerial advisor to the previous National-led government, a National Party member, and who does volunteering work during elections for the finance minister, Nicola Willis. We're going to begin with the hot off the press yesterday, the moves on the ERA legislation and proposed reform, which has come as a result, I think, or certainly off the back of a court decision about the Uber drivers, right? What is it that Minister Brooke Van Velden is proposing here?
Essentially, she's proposing to tidy up the test, in essence. This is part of the ACT National Coalition Agreement, so it's not unforeseen that they were going to intervene, regardless of sort of where the courts went on this. The courts did find, basically, that the Uber drivers in particular were employees, which I think it'd be safe to say that ACT doesn't agree with that and really want to make what they might call a contractor-friendly approach. So they're proposing a test that sort of sets it out really clearly and allows that, you know, people can really openly sign on to be contractors and, you know, have the benefits of the flexible contractor model, but obviously they're not the benefits of the employment model. I think the politics on it are pretty clear for ACT. You know, it's lower regulation to have more contractors, to having a clear test rather than trying to test everything through the courts. So it does seem pretty common sense, I would say, but it obviously is setting up ACT with a direct sort of fight with the unions who are the ones supporting particularly the Uber drivers and previously security drivers and things through the courts.
So the test includes things like you're not restricting if people can have more than one job. There were other things as
well. You sign that you're very clearly a contractor and you don't expect other things. They can't set your hours or days. All of those sort of things. So we sort of expected what we thought, how I think particularly Uber drivers were running. I think there's a lot of grey areas. Courier drivers are perhaps a little bit different.
And is that some sort of protection in there from the perspective of those who say this kind of blurs the lines with employment? For example, if you can't determine the hours that someone works, does that indicate that quite possibly they are more in the contractor area?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, we now know that 900 other Uber drivers now want to become employees. So there's a clear demand for it, that they feel like they're employees, yet they're missing out on things like holiday pay, minimum wage protections, which, you know, employees have. So the employment court used to use what was called the real nature test, whether you're more like an employee or a contractor. And Bridget's right, this is looking like it's much more contractor friendly. That's a bit of a concern, right? Because we're much more in the gig economy now where people are juggling multiple jobs. But if we go too far, you get the ridiculous example which Kensington Swan pointed out in a legal brief before this case, which is the Gloria Vale volunteers, who the Employment Court also declared in a determination were employees, could be, in this future scenario, declared contractors, which would make a farce. So we see other sectors, be it courier drivers or Gloria Vale or Uber drivers, want to get the greater protections of employees.
Will it be, to your point, it's part of the coalition agreement, so will it be an obvious kind of divide, and is it part of the reality that if you form part of government and you get a coalition deal, what was it Michael Cullen famously said, we won, you lost, it goes, eat that, I'm going to get that quote right, because no one ever does.
Yeah, I think it is a sort of traditional left-right divide. You can probably see how Parliament's going to vote on this one. The problem you always have with a number of sectors, but employment law, is that swing back and forth. And so it's going to be interesting. I don't think we've seen much actually from Labor about exactly what they would do in this space. But you could probably expect that, given the pressure of the unions and this being a unions-led case, that Labor is going to have to do something when they come back into government to maybe, what they would say, correct the balance back the other way towards more employee relationships rather than contractor relationships.
Yeah, the Greens came out pretty strongly. Labor sort of hedged a little bit and said, you know, we need to look at the detail, and ultimately we all have to see what the detail actually is. But the risk here is that basically using a sledgehammer to crack a nut. We're talking about a small number of people in this country, mostly using app-based employment, who are covered by this. So the risk is that if you take it too far, we're going to to see much weakening of employment protections
for
non-app-based workers
but
as well.
Growing.
Yeah, and I think the issue is what you sort of pointed out before, is whilst this decision is about pretty much app-based sort of gig-based work, the ramifications and the precedents it's sending is actually further and much wider than that. And that's where I think there's actually real value in the workplace minister actually looking at this, regardless of what the ideology is, that actually some certainty in that test would help a lot of business owners.
We've had it in the creative sector. We had it in the film industry most memorably with the law that was introduced, actually, under the John Key government, right? I hear what you're saying, that it's comparatively small, but nonetheless it's the way increasingly a growing number of people will find themselves working, right?
But the irony is that in the name of certainty, we're now going to go into a period of probably 1 or 2 years of uncertainty while the legislation winds its way through. I mean, the courts were doing their work and doing the process the courts do, and we're seeing yet another case where the courts have made a determination and now the government's legislating on top. However, you're right, it's not a surprise this was baked into the confidence supply agreement.
There's another challenge for Labor.
Coalition agreement.
There's another challenge for Labor on this and many other fronts, which is does its internals, how do we get back to being to winning elections. We focus a lot on tax, but again, this kind of business uncertainty and Shane Jones, who will bit more on him later, use it to great effect and saying, hey, if you won't guarantee contracts that are signed under fast track legislation when you come back, you're creating uncertainty and rah da da da. I'm not endorsing that by any means, but they have to be careful not to be sort of boxed into a corner over what might be perceived as business certainty measures, yeah?
Yeah, and you know, this was an area where Labor during the COVID years skyrocketed to the top of the most best performing party on the economy, which historically hadn't been the case. They've lost that now to National, and you know, they'll be asking themselves, that's a key test of credibility, to look like an incoming government rather than just an opposition. So you know, that's something they're clearly weighing up. I think it was Camilla Belich came out with pretty moderate comments around this, and we need to see the detail.
All right. Now, the treaty principles, the point has been made that long before we even start to see, I think even the principles finalised, let alone the legislation, this is hogging headlines, well and truly. Commentators taking a variety of perspectives on it, but a general theme is, has Christopher Luxon set up a situation where one of his smaller partners, is just going to hog the headlines and keep on hogging the headlines, Bridget?
Yeah, I mean, it's in ACT's interest for this to go as close to the election as possible, because essentially as soon as this is voted out at that sort of second reading spot, you know, and dies, basically they've just opened up for New Zealand First to dominate within this treaty space, because they've still got their agreements about reviewing the particular parts of the legislation, etc., to get through. So I think there is a real risk for ACT here. What I thought was interesting from this week was that I thought you really saw Luxon actually putting his foot down, putting that timing in place, that we would have a bill by November, that this was going to progress on this timetable. I think you're actually seeing a bit of, well, we're not going to let this continue long. We have to, you know, as per our coalition agreement, we agreed to take it to a certain stage, but really trying to manage to say, absolutely, once again, we're not supporting it, so I don't want to waste my time talking about it, but this is the timing.
With respect, Bridget, I think what we just saw was quite an angry and frustrated Prime Minister who sees his coalition partner hogging the limelight, hogging the agenda. You know, he would have much rather been talking about the economy or crime in his post-cap press conference. But in fact,
crime's come down in central Auckland and businesses are smiling and, yeah.
But instead he had to talk about the project of his coalition partner, which isn't going anywhere, but is the dominant issue of this term of government when you look at the wider context on Māori wards and Te Reo and marine and coastal areas. You know, this sort of anti-Māori approach is the defining feature of Luxon's government. And increasingly he's looking like he's being out-negotiated by Seymour, who's, you know, getting all the national attention. We see a host of National Party-aligned columnists in the weekend talk about how Seymour's the big winner from this. You know, Luxon's looking weak, like he can't negotiate, and he's talking about Seymour's policies rather than his own.
I always come back to it on the show, that I think when you say that it's the defining thing of this government, it's a little bit of a beltway analysis of what's happening, because actually you go out in the regions, everyone cares about the economy. All of the polls, everything indicates the economy is still the biggest issue. We are still in a period of, you know, downturn. That is the biggest issue. And I think regardless of what, you know, we can spend a lot of time, and as you say, it was commentators talking about it over the weekend, we're talking about it as commentators here. It's an important issue and we should be talking about it, but it is not the defining issue of this government. I think that just completely disregards actually what's happening out there for households.
For some households, for many households, that's for sure. So these principles as recommended by Seymour, civil government, rights of hapū and iwi Māori, right to equality. But it's a long way short of the details of the actual bill being scoped out. And the other interesting thing to emerge was this issue of a referendum provisions in the bill. Was that always anticipated?
Yeah, that was always anticipated. That was something because Seymour has always been clear that he thinks that the New Zealand people, not the court, should be able to vote on what is their defining constitutional arrangements of government. So that's always been part of the discussion that has been had. He's always wanted a referendum on this. I think in part that's probably why National was opposed to it, because A, they know that's going to be really noisy, and B, really, really costly for not necessarily going to get an outcome that even ACT is seeking.
Well, I'm baffled with it though, because National has only agreed to support it to first reading, to a select committee, and then no more votes. Why on earth would you waste all that money and all that resource that goes into preparing for a referendum, which is never going to happen?
But they're not going to prepare for a referendum because you don't start preparing for a referendum before the bill's passed. So it's going to die at second reading.
And so why
the provision
are they working
is going, well, the provision's going to die. Well, that's a good question. And I think, you know, we can probably talk about, you know, whether Seymour is using the resources of government to actually, you know, he's talking a lot about cost cutting. This is somewhere that you could possibly cost cut. I think that's a real question that he has to, and the cost he has to think about. But ultimately, putting the referendum in there, the cabinet paper getting through, nothing has actually changed in the last week. It's not going to go anywhere.
6-month select committee process as well. There have been a lot of truncated select committees in recent years, some would say far too many, and that this pivotal part of the legislative process is kind of being downgraded. This is getting the full 6 months though, and that is, again, a lot of time for a lot of headlines, a lot of social media chatter wherever you are.
Yeah, and if that's how Seymour wants to use his political capital within the coalition agreements, that's a choice he's clearly made. And it goes back to at the beginning, exactly why I think he's doing it. He campaigned on this area and making, you know, changes to co-governance and all of that rhetoric. So did New Zealand First. And at the moment, it looks like he's not going to have anything to take to the next election about what he's actually achieved in this space. And it's quite possible that New Zealand First will. And that puts him up for a massive problem in terms of coalition arrangement.
And it's a little rich, right? The party that rails against government spending has picked the most expensive and longest possible option with 6 months. But look, I think it's terrible statescraft, terrible for social division, but incredibly smart politics from David Seymour's perspective. He's going to draw this out over the summer period. This is going to be what everyone's debating and protesting at Ratana, at Waitangi. Then you've got the budget when this wraps up, and then he becomes the Deputy Prime Minister, probably around the time of the local body elections, September, October next year. We'll have the Māori wards referendums happening in many of our cities.
So which the councils are up in arms about, and again saying...
Of course, because it's more expenditure that is absolutely unneeded. But he keeps this issue in the public spotlight with him kind of as the sole champion against New Zealand First, against National, who are voting against this legislation. Matthew Hooton sort of painted a picture of him sort of standing up against the woke bureaucratic blob in Wellington as the only voice for that, I think, very small segment of New Zealand. But I'm sure his tactics or his goal is to try and, once the bill's reported back, doesn't get a referendum, try a citizens-initiated referendum so that becomes the big issue at the next election.
I'm just still trying to decide where the constitutional arrangements should really be, and me ticking a box and you ticking a box or not. It tends to typically have a more evolutionary process, does it not? I mean, we're different from so many countries. We don't have a written constitution, right? There's just a series of documents that are perceived to make it up, but... Yeah.
And Seymour's trying to rewrite something that was written, you know, 185 years ago. We've settled into it with the principles and the working.
And the principles are more recent, right?
Yeah, the principles are much more recent, and they are a development. I have seen quite a lot of this rhetoric about him trying to rewrite it. I think we have to be careful because we have taken modern interpretations of the treaty. We absolutely do not have a settled understanding and those principles. And the number one thing, because this is where the rubber hits the road, is actually in where government departments are trying to implement their obligations under the statute they're operating under. And so many of them are getting it wrong or confused or drawn up processes. So you're hearing that call not just from non-Māori, but from iwi as well, that the obligations and responsibilities and what's been demanded on them by government is so weighty and so big that they don't actually have the resources to do it. So there's definitely a problem here to be solved. I just don't think that Seymour's bill is the way that it's going to be solved.
Okay, let's move on again now to the mill closures in the Central North Island. You mentioned the economy. I think we're going to get some GDP stats out, rearview mirror as they always are, that back to negative growth again. It's the anticipation of most, the anticipation of the Reserve Bank later this week. But we're at that stage of a now very long recession, however you measure it, where the pain is really hurting in so many areas. You know, you're seeing the business closures and the mill closure in the central North Island, the Owakuni district, that's already feeling it with the doubts over its ski fields' future and reliability on that. We could argue forever about whether the power company was at fault here, but certainly Shane Jones is doing the korero on that.
Yeah, that's right. And he's, you know, loud and vocal about it, but that's where it sort of ends. You know, we're not seeing any real policy changes. Remember, the government's still 51% owners of the large gentailers. They could be, you know, sending a letter of, you know, amended expectations to these companies. They're not doing that. So, again, a bit of a win-win, I think, for the government, in the sense that Shane Jones looks like the champion of the regions and industry, while they don't really have to do anything. And it's quite a comfortable arrangement that, you know, these gentailers are making $7.4 million a day of profit, or combined earnings of $2.7 billion or $7 million a day. You know, half of that goes to the Crown accounts, which, you know, eases some of the financial pressures the government's under. So again, it's a bit of a blame other people without actually coming up with concrete solutions. But, you know, for this region, this is the largest employer in the Little Apahu district. This is coming at a huge blow.
I think you're right that at the moment it's probably a comfortable position to be in, because they're seen as being taking action because of the rhetoric, and they've promised sector reviews and a lot of, you know, looking at the regulation. But that only has a short lifespan. And, you know, for Shane Jones, he is one of the ministers responsible directly for this. He's not just sitting as a coalition partner on this. He's actually directly responsible for actually making change. And for him, you know, you've got basically that sort of 2 years until the election. Those regions are going to, you know, kick back, I think, if they're not seen as, well, you promised all these things and we're sitting here without any jobs, with half, you know, our generation left the town because they can't get a job. And so I do think that he's going to have to match that rhetoric with actual action, because otherwise it's so stark that nothing has happened.
It did look like there were divisions internally as well. And, you know, Louise Upston said, you know, they did ask for ministerial and power company support, much like TY, you know, has got historically. That wasn't possible, which Louise Upston pointed to. Shane Jones, when he was asked, well, why aren't you helping this company to survive and keep those workers' jobs? He said, well, it is what it is. And we are much more interventionist historically, which I sort of read as they were pushing internally for a deal but weren't able to get it across the line. The difficulty for the government is when you've got such a broken, you know, electricity system, you can't do deals for every single company who threatens to up sticks. But we are seeing companies break, go belly up, workers losing their jobs, and now Methanex is talking about reducing capacity by half.
Well, it uses quite a lot of New Zealand's gas supply, and there are some people who might actually say we could probably be redirecting that. But again, these are big companies, these are big employers, and they return to local economies as well as to New Zealand Inc. The chocolate teapot stuff, though, at the electricity authority and other things. I mean, to Gareth's point, actually, New Zealand First does have policy, I think, on reform of the electricity system. Last time I was talking to Minister Jones, I raised this, but the government does not. And right now, those coffers, we saw the budget documents, OIA documents or official documents released earlier this week. Its own budget is so tight, Bridget. It's not going to be up for sacrificing any more of what's going into its own coffers, one thinks.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's got to be taken into account. What was, you know, really clear from those budget papers that were released this week is some of those, you know, trade-offs that had to be made, and what particularly, you know, coalition partners fought for, and perhaps what they were happy to sort of, well, not happy to give up, but, you know, things that they had to trade off on. And you can see that, you know, Winston Peters, as we already knew, you know, fought hard to make sure that NFAT wasn't affected by the cost cuts as much as other departments. So if he's, you know, if he's played his card on that one, there's obviously going to be a trade-off that you can't play your card in other areas. And he's been around politics long enough to understand those trade-offs and the need to kind of keep a stability of government, at least for, you know, a certain period of time. So I think you're absolutely right. I don't think they're going to make any big moves, because ultimately you are going to be just putting out spot fires everywhere until you actually make that big regulatory change. And frankly, the regulatory change is going to be quite boring. Most people will probably not understand it, because it's the complexity of the regulatory framework is so tough, and you're not going to see the results results of it for probably a couple of years.
So chock the teapot it is in the meantime.
Well, pretty much.
Yeah.
Well, it'll be interesting to see, you know, I think pressure's building up so much in the electricity sector that people are actually looking for some bolder, more structural systemic solutions. So it'll be interesting, does Labor, you know, they're going through their policy review process. Will they go back to the Lake Onslow hydro project, or will they look at, say, the New Zealand Power
oligopoly? That's what everyone says, that's what the companies say, is stop them investing the Lake Onslow project. Why would we invest in more supply if you're talking about removing the need for it?
What I'm saying is there's a whole range of quite, you know, big interventions, you know, compared to what we've done in the last 30 years.
Their interesting one was 10 years ago, which was the single buyer.
Yes, yes.
The NZ Power proposal of David Parker.
And the previous government also looked at structural separation, much like what happened to Telecom with Spark and Chorus, you know, splitting them up into the generator and the retailer elements, because very few countries around the world structure their market in such a way. What was interesting in the Treasury docs, though, was Treasury effectively saying the government's debt headroom was a lot more than what Labor historically or National currently is using. You know, the government's looking at 20% debt targets. Treasury said we could go up to 50%. And just noting that as Labor goes through their policy development process, we see Chris Hipkins saying they could be more open to increasing the debt level to actually invest in much needed social and public infrastructure.
That becomes an interesting debate between how much you pay on your debt and what you get out of it and good use of it. That was interesting. And the other thing is just how tight that operating and how struggling for credibility the future operating budgets are, how tight it is. Very good. We'll leave it there today. Thank you, Bridget Morton and Gareth Hughes.